from KALW News in San Francisco. This is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
The Mission, Excelsior,
Redwood City,
American Canyon,
San Francisco,
Vallejo.
Coming up, we take a closer look at an impending prohibition that's got California foodies in a frenzy.
Foie gras is a 5,000-year-old ingredient, and it's part of what we think is that it's a shame to just throw that away on a moment's notice.
Then we hear about how Oakland School District plans to improve its meal programs.
It really, you know, should be something that's available to all of our citizens, especially our children.
And we talk with author Raj Patel about how fighting for food access can help us fight poverty.
We need to be thinking much more about spreading the love of the food movement beyond the farmers market to everyone in the Bay Area.
The complexities of food. That's today on Cross Currents. Stay tuned. This morning's U.S. Supreme Court ruling on the constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act was a historic moment for the country and the Obama administration. The court upheld virtually every element of the act, including the mandatory purchase of insurance, which means the overhaul of our health care system may pick up steam in the coming years. For Californians, here's what it means. Senator Dianne Feinstein said, as of 2014, California will receive an estimated $14.5 billion in federal funds designated to increase insurance coverage, including an estimated $5.5 billion annually to help low- and middle-income residents purchase insurance. Today, Bay Area leaders from Senator Barbara Boxer to Senator Barbara Lee and Representative Pete Stark of Fremont all hailed the decision as a victory for California. The KALW News team spread out this morning to get local reaction from residents around the Bay. First, reporters Stephen Short set out to Noe Valley and spoke to people there.
My name is Heather Bird, and I'm a stay-at-home mom. I live in Mira Loma Park in San Francisco.
Nita Colgay, and I'm visiting from Connecticut, but I'm living in Noe Valley.
Okay, my name is Maria Horvat, and I am in the Mission District temporarily. I'm basically a housewife, just work for 2 hours a week, basically.
What do you think about the decision by the Supreme Court about the Affordable Health Care Act?
You know, I'm honestly not up to date with what's happening with that. I know that they upheld the bill this morning, but I'm more current on what's happening in Syria than I am in our health care situation, unfortunately.
Do you have health insurance?
We do not. Yeah, I don't have a regular job. My husband works by himself, and so we can't afford it.
I have Medicare. Thank heavens. Well, I think basically people should be not put into private things, which their only desire is to make money off you. I actually applied for long-term health care 3 years ago, and they returned my deposit. They said they really didn't think that I was a good bet for them. I mean, it was the most extraordinary example of the need to make a profit, that they are a business.
We are over 44 years old, and we tried to check on that last year, and the best that we could find was over $500 a month. Believe me, that's bread from the table. We can't pay that amount. Either we have health insurance or we have food.
So I am so grateful for Medicare. I've kept on thinking, well, of course, the states have made us have had health, auto insurance. And everyone agrees that if someone bashes you with their car, if they're not insured, you're screwed. And no one has felt that it was a horrible, evil thing.
How seriously have you been following the healthcare debate?
Kind of close, because we really were worried about this. Really, really worried.
So now the fact that it has been upheld, you're even more worried, I would say.
Absolutely. I'm totally worried because we cannot afford it, and we can't continue to not to afford the big financial companies. We cut off all our ties with banks, mortgage and everything, because it is, you know, basically this step of the government, I would say, that came to benefit financial institutions such as banks, insurance companies, and everything, and we can't afford it.
And now to MacArthur BART station in Oakland, where KALW's Isaac Silk went to get reaction to today's ruling.
My name is Luma Nickel, and I'm retired.
I live in San Francisco in the Glen Park neighborhood.
Gabriel Dominguez. I live in Lafayette, California. I'm a programmer, healthcare.
My name is Brad Hammerson. I live near Lake Merritt, just on the south side. And I do research in microbiology at the Children's Hospital.
Do you have insurance currently?
No.
I have insurance through my domestic partner, yes, and I'm glad for it.
I do have insurance. It's cost me an arm and a leg because my kids are back east, so it's separate altogether. But I was out of job for about 6 months without insurance, and I'm telling you, it sucked big time. Couldn't get my blood pressure pills without having to pay an arm and a leg. Couldn't go see my doctor as often as I wanted to. No, hopefully, this will fix at least most of what's broken.
I think I'll probably, to be honest, not have it as long as I can get away with it, really, until my job can provide it for me. Because otherwise, I couldn't afford it. I've looked into what it costs to just buy your own insurance, just as an individual unattached from a group rate on a, at a business or something like that. It's ridiculous. So.
So I guess under the law, then you'll be forced to pay what they're calling a tax.
Yeah, I guess I would end up trying to pay that if it's cheaper, and if it's not, then I would just buy the insurance.
I think what we need is a nationalized healthcare system, the same as they have in Europe and Canada. And although I'm glad the Supreme Court, decided in favor of Obama's healthcare legislation, I think really his legislation is designed to help insurance companies more than anything else. We're not at the solution to this problem yet.
Whether you're elated, saddened, or neutral, we'd like to hear your thoughts on the Supreme Court's decision to uphold the Affordable Care Act. Leave us a message at 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. As people around the country mull over how the Supreme Court decision will affect their lives, we at Cross Currents are considering one law that'll soon be affecting what we can eat. On July 1st, it'll be against California law to produce or sell any liver from force-fed birds. That may sound irrelevant to you, but to many, that's the source of a premier culinary delicacy, foie gras. Foie gras has been around for longer than you may think. If you were to enter the tomb of Mereruka, a royal official who lived in Egypt around 2500 BC, you'd find a sculpture depicting several men grasping geese by their throats and pushing food into their mouths. It turns out the tradition of fattening birds through overfeeding is a very old one. Today, foie gras can cost over $100 a pound, but many people consider the production of foie gras to be unnecessarily cruel. Farmers must fatten duck or goose livers up to 12 times their usual size by force-feeding the animals several times a day. The law was passed in 2004, giving foie gras producers 7.5 years to change their operations. Now, its implementation is just days away. Over the past few months, there's been an outcry among foie gras supporters who still hope to overturn the ban. So, why so much fuss over a delicacy? KALW's Nina Gensler-Debs has the story.
San Francisco's Humphrey Slocum Ice Cream Parlor is known for its unique flavor selection. On a given week, your choices might include sour cream, salt and pepper, and prosciutto. And right now, they have a special option. It will only be available until July 1st. Tyler Puglisi is waiting in line to get it before it's gone.
I'm gonna try the foie gras ice cream because I think foie gras is delicious and very good, and I'm looking forward to it in a creamy like sauce that's cold. So I will come back and tell you exactly what I think of it.
Yes, a foie gras ice cream sandwich. Humphrey Slocum put them on the menu in the summer of 2009. In the past few months, they've produced approximately 3 dozen sandwiches each day and have sold out every single one. Who's buying them? People like Tyler, San Francisco gourmands, and just curious eaters.
Sorry, we're all out.
Humphrey Slocum isn't alone in its tribute to the soon-to-be-banned delicacy. Restaurants around California are featuring foie gras on their menus, creating unique and lavish dishes, and even holding multi-course dinners devoted to the food. Offerings include items like foie and eel terrine, seared foie with lamb's tongue, and foie gras toffee. A few minutes after we talk, Puglisi comes back holding his $5 treasure, a smallish ice cream sandwich with two house-made ginger snaps on the outside and a thick slab of buttery ice cream within.
So I went to go order it, and for a second they told me that they were out of them for dramatic effect, and I felt this horrible thing in my throat, like someone was opening it up and shoving down despair. But then they got out more, and I'm eating it right now, and it's the most amazing thing I've ever tasted. It's like Christmas duck, but sweet and salty and full of wonder and amazement.
That's how a lot of people seem to feel. Walking down the line, people grasp to find words that describe the food they're willing to buck social stigma to attain.
That hint of foie gras in the background that you wouldn't think would be all that tasty when you first hear about it, but surprisingly, foie gras lends itself very well to ice cream, and it's a combination made in heaven.
We actually had foie gras for dinner, and now I'm having it for dessert, too. You can really get some of the savory, fatty flavor of it.
It tastes good. I like it. Tastes like foie gras ice cream inside of ginger snap cookies.
Would you eat it again?
Yes. And thankfully, I usually live on the other coast where they're not banning foie gras.
Foie gras has already been banned in countries such as Israel, Sweden, and the United Kingdom. But California will be the first U.S. state to ban it. After leaving Humphrey Slocum, I stopped by Encanto Restaurant in Noe Valley to speak to chef-owner Mark Pastore, one of the band's most vocal opponents.
We're not advocating that everybody should eat foie gras. What we're advocating for is that people ought to be able to choose for themselves what they do and don't eat.
When Pastore says we, he's talking specifically about a group called the Coalition for Ethical Farming Standards, or, appropriately, chefs.
And we are proposing a set of veterinary-based standards for the production of foie gras to set a standard for this animal husbandry practice rather than just banning something.
Here's how foie gras is currently produced. This is in most places. There are some exceptions. When geese or ducks are between 9 and 25 weeks of age, farmers begin force-feeding them. In order to feed them, they insert a tube down the bird's throat. This process is called gavage, and it takes about 30 seconds. Over the course of a few weeks, the bird's liver increases from an initial weight of around 80 grams to between 600 and 1,000 grams. Pastore says we can't assume we know what an animal's feeling during this process.
It's easy to anthropomorphize and to think about the horror of having a tube shoved down your throat. But fundamentally, foie gras ducks and geese are different than humans. They don't have a gag reflex.
The process essentially involves mutilating an animal's vital organs to make them taste better. And in the process, the animal is suffering, severely ill and diseased. And if the animal weren't slaughtered, they would simply be dying from that process.
Carter Dillard is head of litigation at the Animal Legal Defense Fund, an organization that uses the legal system to protect animal welfare. He says gavage is
a barbaric practice, which really, from our perspective, is beyond the pale. And that's why California was smart enough to pass a ban, which is going to go into effect in July.
Chefs has submitted a draft bill that would repeal the ban, but change state law to require that foie gras sold or produced in California meet humane treatment standards. Things like keeping birds in a cage-free environment and feeding them less food each day. Dillard says that's not enough.
The key issue here really is the size of the liver. Its size gives you an indication of how diseased it is. So the fact that the current revamped methods still embrace the large dysfunctional liver shows that it's really just window dressing, and what they're after is to maximize profit at the welfare of these animals.
There's another objection to the ban, that it's too narrowly focused. Daniel Patterson owns several high-profile Bay Area restaurants, including Qua, Il Cane Rosso, and Plum. He's not a member of Chefs, but he's been active in the foie gras movement.
I think they're targeting a food that a fraction of 1% of the population eats. So it's basically, it's a meaningless gesture.
And since foie gras is a small industry, Patterson says it's an easier target than other meat production processes.
I think it's especially unfortunate because government could make a stand in favor of the health of all animals that are raised for us to feed ourselves, but they're not doing that.
And there are a lot of animals raised to feed us. The USDA estimates that in 2011, U.S. eaters consumed a whopping 25.6 billion pounds of beef, not to mention all the poultry and pork consumed in that year. Patterson says that people who really want to help animals should focus their attention on those big players.
And so I think, you know, if we can get to a point of education, especially with the kids that are growing up now, about that it matters where something came from and how it was raised, then I think that's the way that we'll be able to evolve our food culture in the future.
Since foie gras production is such a tiny percentage of the U.S. meat industry, I asked Dillard why it's gotten so much media attention and raised so much controversy. He said it's about the lengths producers go to for a slightly better taste.
It's moving beyond eating animals for food. If you ate a duck liver for food, you wouldn't be force-feeding the animal over a three-week period to enlarge its liver 10 or 12 times its normal size. It's foie gras beyond that. It's really the process of mutilating the animal simply to make them taste better, which is a lot more egregious, I think, in most people's minds than simply eating the animal itself.
A repeal before July 1st seems unlikely, but chefs hope to overturn the ban at the 2013 legislative session. State Senator Lois Wolk has already announced that she is considering composing legislation to aid their cause. Police and animal control officials in San Francisco have said they don't have specific plans to enforce the ban, but there's technically a $1,000 fine per violation. So for now, people are still flocking to get their share of foie gras before it's gone. For Cross Currents, I'm Nina Gensler-Debs.
How do you feel about the foie gras ban? Post on our Facebook page. We're KALW News. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. Dishes like foie gras are prepared by chefs worldwide for an elite population of restaurant-goers. But one famous chef broke out of the bourgeois customer base and embraced another, American schoolchildren.
In all of my years, I've never seen pizza given for breakfast in any country. Who knows what this is?
Potatoes.
So you think these are potatoes? This is the future of America.
What's wrong with that?
2 years ago, British chef Jamie Oliver took it upon himself to start a food revolution in America's school cafeterias, going around the country encouraging better food choices in schools. And the message got across, including here in the Bay Area. Over these past few years, Berkeley School District has made national news with its school lunch improvements. Now Berkeley's neighbor, Oakland, is trying to get a food revolution going, too. The Oakland Unified School District serves about 6.5 million meals per year. This volume makes the task of overhauling the school food system a daunting one. The Oakland School District conducted a study of its nutrition services, and the report recommended facility improvements, fresher and more organic ingredients, and the construction of a large central commissary with an organic farm. In a district where, in some schools, as many as 90% of students depend on free or reduced lunch, these are big issues. KALW's Jen Chien brings us the story.
It's 5:30 p.m. at Prescott Elementary School in West Oakland, and the first wave of kids is coming into the cafeteria for supper. Kindergartners come in first, toting backpacks and showing off their missing front teeth as they line up to get chili, cornbread, vegetables, and fresh fruit.
This chili makes you healthy.
How come?
I got an apple.
It's healthy food, you know, and I really appreciate them having that.
Laura McCrae's granddaughter, Shayla, is a second grader at Prescott.
Some of us just really can't afford to send lunch and stuff like that.
Prescott is one of 9 schools in the district that have started serving supper this year. It's part of a free after-school program that about half of Prescott's students participate in. After-school coordinator Jason Peters says the hot meal, which comes at the end of the afternoon's activities, has had a noticeable effect on the students.
Because hunger is stress on your body, and when those things combine with the doubt that can come into a child's mind about whether they're going to get fed or not, it leads into their behavior.
The cafeteria is noisy, but the kids seem relaxed, eating, playing games like Connect Four or Jenga, or just hanging out.
This year we're seeing less of the aggression from our students, and I think some of that is attributed by our supper program and us keeping the kids fed.
Kids at Prescott are not alone in this need. District-wide, Oakland schools serve about 9,000 breakfasts per day, plus 21,000 lunches, 8,500 snacks, and, as of this past year, 500 suppers.
It's really a huge public health issue.
Ruth Woodruff is a founding member of the Oakland School Food Alliance, a group of public school parents who've been pushing for healthier food at their children's schools.
Alameda County has the highest rates of childhood obesity, and we know that that leads to secondary diseases like diabetes and puts people at risk for heart disease.
Woodruff lives with her husband and three kids in the city's upper middle class Rock Ridge neighborhood and says she pays a lot of attention to what she feeds her own family.
We stay away from processed foods at home. We eat, you know, we don't eat anything we can't pronounce. We try to eat locally and sustainably. We eat grass-fed when we can and, you know, pastured eggs and, you know, whole foods, essentially. And that's not at all what was being served in Oakland.
She says originally she was just interested in getting more nutritious food into her own son's elementary school. But as she looked deeper into the issues, she saw there was more to do. In addition to medical concerns like obesity and diabetes that stem from unhealthy food, a lot of kids in Oakland simply don't get enough food. An empty belly makes focus and concentration difficult, and the stress of hunger can lead to depression, anxiety, even PTSD. As a result, Woodruff and other reform proponents see school food not just as a nutritional issue, but as a social justice issue.
This goes across racial and socioeconomic lines, and everybody is concerned about the food that we're feeding our children.
And, she says, school districts here in a foodie heaven like the Bay Area should be at the forefront of reform.
We have amazing food here. We get to eat some of the most wonderful food on earth, I think. And it really, you know, should be something that's available to all of our citizens, especially our children.
We've known there is a need.
Jennifer Labar has been the district's nutrition services director for 8 years. In that time, she's consistently fought for improvements in school meals.
Quite frankly, it's been slow and steady wins the race.
The changes have been incremental, but Labar is proud of them. In 2001, Oakland was the first school district in the state to ban the sale of soda and candy on campus. Labar has instituted vegetarian meals on Meatless Mondays. There are now salad bars in 62 of the district schools and weekly farmers markets at 22 schools. And the district recently did a comprehensive study on what could still be improved. Parent Deandra Kess-McDougall, whose first-grade son often eats breakfast, lunch, and supper at Prescott Elementary, says she really appreciates this focus on healthy food.
They have a salad bar for them. They have spinach opposed to, you know, lettuce, or they have fruits and they have vegetables.
She says they already avoided soda and candy at home. But daily conversations with her son about what he eats at school have affected her own cooking.
They taught me to actually how to give him more vegetables and, you know, on how to just focus his mind on the, you know, the four different food groups and stuff like that.
Behind the Prescott School cafeteria is one of the district's two central kitchens. Here, they prepare 20,000 meals every day in a facility that was designed for 8,000. Moves toward automation and individual packaging in the school food industry, plus declining enrollments, have made individual school kitchens financially unsustainable. So, most of the district's food preparation now takes place in centralized kitchens, where a lot of the food comes in already made. Jennifer Labar says one of the things the study found
is that our employees are not underskilled when it comes to cooking. They're underutilized. So for years, we've been paying our cooks to open up boxes of frozen food and put them on trays and stick them into the oven. And they had wonderful cooking skills. We just weren't using them.
The study also found a pressing need for facility and equipment upgrades. Recently, a section of the Prescott playground had to be removed to make room for a loading dock. The kitchen itself is crowded with boxes and heavy equipment, much of it old or outdated. The dishwasher has been broken for at least 3 years, but John Johnson, a 30-year employee of Oakland Unified's Nutrition Services, still manages a smile as he hand-washes some huge metal pans.
John Johnson.
He says he would definitely welcome upgrades to the kitchen facilities.
You got a basically small kitchen for a big operation here. And the more the space, the more the better if we can equip, you know, stuff to bring in, and we can have more room to put things instead of piling everything, you know, in one little corner.
The completed nutrition services study calls for changes like creating a 1.5-acre organic farm and garden and building a new central kitchen. 14 unused school kitchens would be turned into school community kitchens, which the public could access year-round. Now, they just have to find a way to pay for it. The school district has some existing partnerships with community organizations, and it's looking for private funders. The school board may also put a bond measure on the November ballot. District spokesman Troy Flint says that the bond would probably be $500 million.
It's a difficult decision because even though these are worthy projects, it's a really treacherous time to put forth a bond measure, especially in a city like Oakland, which has relatively high poverty levels and high taxation already. But this is an investment in our future.
Still, Jennifer Labar says she feels optimistic.
The time is right. You know, I think if we can't find funding sources, given the climate about people's, you know, people are really concerned about children's health and specifically around the National School Lunch Program. And if we can't find funding sources now, then there's a big problem in the world.
And parents like Deandra Kess-McDougall say the investment is worth it.
It all depends on what we eat at home. You know what I'm saying? So if we see them getting nutritious food at school, then that would change our recipes at home because it's changed mine a lot. A lot.
The kids are already on board.
Yeah? Tell me why you like apples.
Because they're juicy and healthy for you.
I like apples because they're crunchy.
Why do you like apples?
Because they're good and good for your body.
In West Oakland, I'm Jen Chien for Cross Currents.
Listening to Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba. The Bay Area is one of the country's centers for food activism and for the whole idea that local efforts can have big effects on the food system as a whole. Raj Patel is author of the book Stuffed and Starved, a critical look at the inequalities in food access around the world. He spoke with KALW's Casey Miner about the upcoming reauthorization of the Farm Bill. That's the legislation that governs almost everything about food policy in the U.S. and what fighting for food access really means.
Food access is a part of a bigger issue around fighting poverty. There's much more poverty now than there used to be 5 years ago because of the recession. And yet, because of the way our politics works, there's much less political will at the moment to fight poverty than there was, you know, in 2008. There's a very real split between Republicans and Democrats when it comes to thinking about whether the poor deserve to be hungry or not. And really, that's what we're seeing in the debate around the Farm Bill is various proposals that will slash the food stamp component of the Farm Bill. In the Senate bill, there's a $4 billion cut being proposed. But in the House, you're seeing levels of cut ranging from $33 billion to $130 billion.
And so what do you think is the role of local food activism then in kind of coming into this conversation? In the Bay Area, we have a huge array of organizations that produce local food, that start urban farms, that talk about ways ways to develop locally sustainable food systems within the city. I mean, what is the relationship of those kinds of organizations to this kind of bigger policy debate? And what do you think are some of the limitations of that kind of movement?
Well, because of the recession, a lot of food movements and food justice organizations are being sucked into being sort of emergency service providers and making sure that the hungriest people who and a large slice of the of people who are on food stamps are children. Making sure that those children get enough to eat is obviously a priority. The trouble is that in being sucked into this sort of service provision role, it can be that organizations have resources diverted away from building the sort of longer term infrastructure to make sure that we in the Bay Area are able to feed everyone within the Bay Area. But I think we ought to be looking to organizations like the Black Panthers, oddly, because in the 1960s and early 1970s, the Black Panthers had a school breakfast program and free meals and free food for the hungry and also free prescriptions and a range of services that were necessary in order to ameliorate poverty. But what the Black Panthers also had was a vision for social change so that we wouldn't need food banks and we wouldn't need these stopgap measures. And I think what the best organizations in the Bay Area are doing, and there are many of them, is that those organizations are allowing us to dream to a stage where we don't need these the sort of patchwork of entitlements because we won't have the kinds of poverty that sadly we do at the moment in the Bay Area. And those organizations are doing everything from training people, having jobs with living wages in the food industry, and far too few people in the food industry do have jobs with living wages. Around 80% of people working in the food industry and food service particularly are unable to feed themselves on the wages they have. So the organizations in the Bay Area that are really at the cutting edge that I'm really inspired by are making sure not only that we meet the sort of short-term survival needs of the hungry in the Bay Area, but going deeper than that are ensuring that we don't have hunger in the Bay Area because everyone is able to access food regardless of their station or their income.
And what do you think are some of the challenges that those organizations might face as they delve more deeply into the kinds of things you're talking about, not just meeting immediate needs, but actually changing that infrastructure and developing something that's locally sustainable?
The greatest challenge, of course, is that there's precious little money. I mean, the recession and the policies that we have employed to fight the recession are the politics of austerity. And austerity means that you are not paying living wages for jobs, that there is that there are not the kinds of supports required to make sure that people on pensions, for example, have access to sustainable food. Now, that funding crunch happens across the board, whether in the philanthropic world or in the public sector. And I think that financial imposition is also mirrored by a politics in this state that seems to see politicians out-competing one another to avoid raising taxes. On the bright side, of course, more and more citizens are realizing that it's okay to raise taxes if we know where they're going and we appreciate the virtues of spending those taxes on the most needy in our community. So I think the challenges are about funding and also about the political atmosphere.
We're speaking with Raj Patel. He's the author of Stuffed and Starved. You know, the Bay Area has a pretty well-developed food culture, and people are very invested in talking about food, both for its own sake and in relationship to these other social issues. Is that something that you see developing or as a possibility in somewhere where there really isn't as much of a constant conversation about food, about farming, about local, sustainable, you know, all those things that are kind of buzzwords here, but maybe are just as important in a lot of other places?
We're lucky in California to be able to have fresh local produce right on our doorstep. I think there are fewer parts of the United States or the world that have the cornucopia on which we sit. But we're also extremely lucky to have a history of social organizing, particularly in parts of the East Bay. And that's much harder to find because the kinds of bonds within communities and the kinds of understanding that organization can make change, that kind of stuff, that social capital, if you like, takes a very long time to build up. And although it can be destroyed, it seems to be one of the reasons why if you go to the East Bay, you can find everything from city slicker farms to people's grocery to Fat Beats to Food First to the Oakland Food Policy Council, you can see so many organizations that are really committed to understanding that if we're to make sure that everyone gets fed, then we must do it together. And that kind of will to work together is actually quite rare. And so I think we're very lucky in the Bay Area to have that too.
Raj, I'm wondering, just is there anything that you think is missing from our discussion about food and the food system and what it means for other social issues?
It's lovely to be able to eat locally in the Bay Area, but often what's forgotten in those conversations about eating locally is the labor that has gone into the food. And the voices of farm workers are often missing from the conversations around food and sustainability. So I think that's something we need to pay attention to. We also need to be cognizant of the fact that it's great to be able to go to your farmer's market, but what about the people who aren't able to? What about the people who are too poor to be able to go to those farmer's markets, or who are homebound? We need to be thinking much more about spreading the love of the food movement beyond the farmers market to everyone in the Bay Area.
That's Raj Patel, author of Stuffed and Starved, speaking with KALW's Casey Miner. You can find links to more food and environment coverage, as well as all of our pieces, all on our website. It's KALW.org. That's it for today's edition of Cross Currents from KALW News. The team includes Julie Kane, Audrey Dilling, Fatima Duran, Brian Flagg, Emily Gaddick, Nina Gensler-Debs, Jordan Katz, RTM's Kanahovs, Eric Amu, Seth Samuel, Stephen Short, Isaac Silk, and Mariel Wallof. Today's show is engineered by Chris Hoff. Casey Miner is our senior editor. Martina Castro is our managing editor. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. Holly Kernan is our news director. And thanks to you, we are listener-supported radio.
B stands for Patty, I suppose.
The music you're hearing is by the Bay Area trio called Golden Bough. These modern-day minstrels mostly make music rooted in ancient Celtic ballads, but they often add some original compositions to their live shows. They're playing tomorrow at the Freight and Salvage in Berkeley, beginning at 8 o'clock. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.